This is OBG Project's Grand Rounds Live, a podcast of the OBG Project's monthly webinar featuring cutting-edge OB and GYN topics. Our Grand Rounds Live webinar is free for OBG First members. With an OBG First membership, you have access to the webinar slides, handouts, and future Grand Rounds Live webinars. To learn more about membership and other perks of an OBG First membership, go to obgproject.com/get-first. Enjoy the webinar.
Hello, and welcome to the OBG Project's Grand Rounds Live for February of 2022. This month, we're featuring Dr. Tamara Goldwasser, an author on the new and recent practice resource published by the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics called Screening for Autosomal Recessive and X-Linked Conditions During Pregnancy and Preconception. Today, we're going to be discussing genetic screening and answering all of your burning questions on how to counsel patients. And so without further ado, Dr. Goldwasser, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's a pleasure to be here. And I'm so excited to share with you everything that's new in carrier screening. And I have no disclosures. And just to start with a little bit of a historical perspective of how carrier screening began and where we got to today, in 1968, Wilson and Junger published their first classic carrier screening criteria, which included a list of criteria that we want to meet when recommending carrier screening on a population basis. And the criteria included things like the condition should be important or severe, there should be appropriate treatment available for the condition. They also included criteria such as cost. So cost should be something that is reasonable and economically balanced. In the 1970s, I have a picture of you for you here. Carrier screening for Tay-Sachs disease was offered, and actually the whole team got together on a van and went around town offering carrier screening for Tay-Sachs disease using enzyme analysis. And this was the team. In the 1980s, screening for thalassemia programs developed. And in the 1990s, cystic fibrosis became the first condition for which population-based carrier screening was recommended. This was followed by carrier screening recommendations for SMA population-wide. And then in 2015, next-gen sequencing entered the stage and really changed what we can do and offer in carrier screening overall. So just to start, what is carrier screening? So it's genetic testing. And nowadays, it's genetic testing for a lot of different genes and a lot of different conditions. But let's talk about what it's designed to do. So it's designed to test people who are thinking of having children to let them know if they happen to carry any conditions or any genetic changes that could be passed on to their children that could lead to genetic conditions. And we're usually looking at recessive conditions where most of the time, if you find out that a patient is a carrier, you're not giving them a new diagnosis. But if two people get together and they're both carriers for the same autosomal recessive condition, they face a 25% chance of having a baby with that condition. And also, we do carrier screening for X-linked conditions. So these are conditions that usually get passed on from the mother who's usually healthy, and we see the diseases in their most severe form in her male children. And we still have the same carrier, same idea when we set criteria for carrier screening. So we want to be sure that the condition is important and that it's severe, either physically debilitating or something that could affect children or something that can shorten the lifespan or have a severe impact on intellectual functioning or neurocognitive development. We want to also be able to order tests that have validity. So if the tests should be reliable, and we shouldn't be giving patients results that we can't explain. But it's really not designed to be diagnostic, as I said, so you're not testing people for autosomal dominant conditions. So that would be something like the inherited predisposition for breast cancer in BRCA1, for instance, or inherited predisposition for high cholesterol, like familial hypercholesterolemia. And carrier screening can be done on a blood test or saliva. You just need DNA from the patient. And with carrier screening, you know, the main metric to measure carrier screening is reproductive decision making. Okay, so reproductive decision making is really the metric for population-based carrier screening recommendations, because the whole idea is we want to allow couples to have this information so that they could take full advantage of all the different options that are available. And when we offer carrier screening, there is an element of counseling that should take place before the testing is done, and this is called pretest counseling. So we want to be able to, and with my new guideline that I'm going to share with you shortly, we explain that we want to offer screening to all patients and kind of take out the confusion for providers on who to offer this test to versus who to offer another test to. And it should really be built into the electronic medical record. Most offices use an electronic medical record nowadays. And so we want it to be a question that's populated for every annual visit, so that every time you see a patient, if they're in their reproductive years, you ask them about their intentions to have children, you offer carrier screening. And although we offer it at every annual visit in reproductive years, it is optional, it's not required. And when we offer testing, we want to explain, listen, if the results come back negative, it's going to greatly reduce your risk to have a child with any of the conditions on that panel, but that risk is never going to be zero, and I will explain that in a little bit. And really, the best time to offer carrier screening is when there is no pregnancy ongoing, because once pregnancy is there, the clock is ticking and tensions run high, and there's a lot of anxiety around, is my baby at risk? I'm already well into this pregnancy. And so you really want to try and catch people before pregnancy or before they pursue IVF or any reproductive technologies. And we want to offer this carrier screening to all patients annually, but definitely with each new pregnancy and with each new reproductive partner. So even if a patient had adequate carrier screening, but now she's reproducing with a different partner, and you want to readdress carrier screening and take a look at it. And again, this is going to impact their reproductive decisions. And so in 2015, there was a joint committee statement put out by many of the different societies, the American College of Medical Genetics, the American College of OBGYN, the National Society for Genetic Counselors, and the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine. And this joint committee statement really set the stage for the new guidelines that have now been published. And it was a call for a new carrier screening guideline to fit the new genomic era, where now we are not just testing for a set number of mutations in any given gene, but with genetic sequencing, we're looking at each gene from start to finish and identifying every single genetic change therein. So more in the pretest counseling, right? So we talk about all these reproductive options. What are they? Let's say a couple is found to both be carriers for the same recessive condition. They have the option to think about gamete donation, either using an egg donor or a sperm donor. They have the option to look into adoption. They have the option to decide not to reproduce. They can look into in vitro fertilization, where using assisted reproductive technologies, they have sperm and eggs. Embryos are created in the lab. And with pre-implantation genetic testing, you can test each embryo for the specific genetic disease that is in question. And they also have the option of prenatal diagnosis. So patients can decide, okay, we do have a 25% risk, but that means that we have a 75% chance to have a baby that's not affected. Let's get pregnant and either pursue CVS, which is a chorionic villus sampling, or amniocentesis, where amniotic fluid is withdrawn. CVS can be done between 10 to 14 weeks, and amniocentesis can be done starting at around 16 weeks. And with either of those, they're diagnostic. You can find out if the fetus is either affected with two mutations or a carrier, or maybe has not inherited either copy from either parent. And at that point, if you learn that the fetus is affected, then parents have the opportunity to prepare for the medical care of a child that might need certain specialty medical care. Or a lot of times during a pregnancy, many life decisions are also happening. So you might be looking at a new job in a new city, and you might want to consider what kind of public services are there in that city, or you might be looking into buying a new house in a new neighborhood. And so a lot of other life decisions might be impacted by the knowledge that the child is expected to have a certain condition. And couples are also offered the opportunity for termination if they so choose. Another nuance to the pretest counseling. See, pretest counseling can be, it can sound overwhelming and complex, but this is really not to be intimidating. I'll just pause and explain. Doctors and other providers and genetic counselors who offer carrier screening just need to have some comfortability with the different options of outcomes of what might happen when you do carrier screening. And so one interesting phenomenon is the concept of manifesting carriers. So usually we think we're going to do carrier screening. Even if you're a carrier for one thing and your partner is a carrier for another thing, you're fine, your partner's fine. It's just about the risk to the fetus. But sometimes we see that even a carrier can have some manifestation. So one example is ATM. So if a patient is found to be a carrier for ATM, it's an autosomal recessive cause of ataxia telangiectasia, where children, if inherited two mutations in the ATM gene, so homozygous affected patients can have cerebellar ataxia, so imbalance and oculomotor issues and childhood leukemias and ocular telangiectasias. So that's a childhood onset condition. But even one patient who has one mutation does also have a risk for adult onset cancers. So if I have a patient who's found to have one mutation in the ATM gene, she faces a 4 times increased lifetime risk for cancer, and that's primarily due to the increased risk in breast cancer. And so that patient would be referred for high-risk breast cancer screening, which would usually involve using MRI in addition to mammogram. Another example is in the FMR1 gene, which is the gene that can lead to Fragile X syndrome. So if a patient is a carrier for Fragile X and she has a premutation in the FMR1 gene, she's not expected to have any manifestations of Fragile X. So she doesn't have intellectual disability or any of the other manifestations. However, she is at increased risk for premature ovarian failure. And so with this information, which you're going to share with her, she may have her ovarian reserve or her ovarian function assessed either by ultrasound or lab work or both. And at that point, she'll have the option of looking into fertility preservation with egg freezing or making embryos for the future. And it may impact other life decisions that she may have. Other conditions that are X-linked, like hemophilia and Fabry, usually affect males, but there are, hemophilia, X-linked condition. So sometimes we find that female carriers for hemophilia A or B can also have an increased propensity for bleeding. And so it's really important when you are taking care of someone who's pregnant, you want to involve the anesthesiologist and maybe a hematologist before she is approaching the time for delivery. Again, this is something we've known for a while. Female carriers for Duchenne muscular dystrophy, they themselves don't have Duchenne muscular dystrophy, but they do have an increased risk for cardiomyopathy, and you will be doing the right thing by sending her to have a cardiology evaluation. And the same thing goes with Fabry. So usually the classic presentation is males with an enzyme activity that's less than 1%. But sometimes you can have a female carrier who can manifest with just a severe amount of disease as an affected male. So she, which can involve her heart, she may have cardiomyopathy, she may have renal failure. And so this is also an important finding. And again, the lab report will clue you into this, and I'll show you an example. Another element of pretest counseling is implications for medical care and pregnancy care. So it may be shocking, but every once in a while, we don't just find that someone is a carrier, but we find that she doesn't have one mutation, but she actually has two mutations or two pathogenic variants on each copy of that gene. And so, for example, Gaucher disease. If we test a patient for carrier screening in her late teens, early 20s, you may find that she not only is a carrier for Gaucher, but she's actually affected. So patients with Gaucher, how can this be that she never knew? Well, sometimes the symptoms are really vague and nonspecific, and patients can have what's called a diagnostic odyssey, where they have fatigue, they have easy bruising, they may have abdominal distension, and it may take a while until the diagnosis is made. And another thing is that different people, even in the same family, so they can even have the exact same mutation or the exact same genetic variant in the gene for Gaucher, and one is very mildly affected and one is more severely affected. And so every once in a while, you might even have a diagnosis to give. The same goes for CAH, congenital adrenal hyperplasia due to 21-hydroxylase deficiency. Now some of the labs are offering carrier screening for this, and we are finding that some patients are not so much the classic form of 21-hydroxylase deficiency, but we're diagnosing many non-classic, and a lot of these women have previously carried a diagnosis of PCOS, where the manifestations are pretty similar to non-classic CAH. And same goes for PKU. Classic PKU will result in irreversible intellectual disability if the baby is exposed to phenylalanine after birth. So there's phenylalanine in breast milk, there's phenylalanine in the typical baby formula. But actually, different genetic changes in the same gene can lead to varying residual degrees of enzyme activity. And so some patients, even though they may carry two mutations in this gene, may actually be very mildly affected and have normal intellectual function and had no idea that they have PKU, and it's actually not even called PKU, it's just instead called hyperphenylalaninemia. And it's really important, especially when you're starting a pregnancy, to refer those patients to have their phenylalanine levels checked, because you want to be able to prevent PKU embryopathy. Another interesting phenomenon, so I love this and I think this is interesting, and remember, you can always phone a friend in the world of genetics, but there are other nuances. So there's something called a genotype-phenotype correlation, which sometimes really changes our counseling. So if someone is a carrier for cystic fibrosis, then you usually will tell them, okay, cystic fibrosis is a disease that is autosomal recessive, and it affects the mucus in lungs and in the digestive tract, and you get frequent lung infections. But some mutations in the CFTR gene really are much milder. So for instance, if you identify something called the 5T allele in the CFTR gene, then you may tell parents that with an additional CFTR mutation, you might expect a child with congenital bilateral absence of the vas deferens, which could lead to infertility in a male, or even completely asymptomatic. Another example is actually in CAH, which we talked about a little bit, but the classic form, when you have two pathogenic variants in the CYP21A2 gene, it leads to classic salt wasting or simple virilizing 21-hydroxylase deficiency. And so if you're expecting a baby who's going to have either classic or simple salt wasting 21-hydroxylase deficiency, it's really important to alert the NICU, alert the nurses who are going to take care of the neonate. You're going to want to make sure that you check electrolytes on this baby before sending them home. But other variants in the same gene can really cause a very mild form. So certain variants are well known, like the V281L variant can really just almost exclusively lead to a non-classic CAH, which is sort of a little bit of extra hirsutism, and females who may need assistance getting pregnant, and they may need to take Clomid or a steroid to help get pregnant. And lastly, another example that we see, the NPHS2 gene, if you inherit two mutations that are pathogenic mutations, it's an autosomal recessive condition, and it leads classically to focal segmental glomerular sclerosis. With nephrotic syndrome, this can lead to kidney failure and the need for transplant. But other variants in the exact same gene, if inherited together, really don't have any manifestations, and you can counsel patients that you really would be expecting a healthy baby. And so, again, the pressure is not on you to know all of these different specific nuances in every gene. Just read the fine print, and when you see that someone's a carrier, just ask yourself, is this one of those conditions where there's an extra paragraph that might say something like the patient might be manifesting, or genetic counseling is recommended? Just remember to read the fine print. Okay, now you've done your testing, you find out that someone is a carrier for something. So what do you do then? So you want to be able to call the family and call the patient, review the family history of both the patient and the reproductive partner, and just give a brief clinical description of the disorder, which you can either get on UpToDate, or it may be in the test report, or you can call a genetic counselor at the laboratory to help. And then you want to bring in the reproductive partner and offer them something called full gene sequencing. So you don't want to do a test. So there, we've all seen tests, let's say for cystic fibrosis, where they'll say we checked for this number of mutations, 21 mutations, 97 mutations. You want them to look at the entire gene from start to finish to look for any variants in that gene. And if the test is negative for the partner, then you can reassure the couple that the risk to have an affected child is very reduced. But again, it's never going to be zero. And the reason it's never zero is because sometimes a gene can be the predominant cause of a certain disease, but there could be other genes that can also, when mutated or when there is a pathogenic variant, can also lead to the exact same disease. So even if the person doesn't have any identifiable mutations in the genes tested, it doesn't completely rule out that possibility of having an affected child. Another way that your residual risk is never going to be zero is sometimes we're limited by what technology has to offer. And so sometimes even with the best testing that we have today, there could be changes in a gene that you are looking at that you're just not able to detect with the technology we have. And always remember to offer invasive diagnostic testing. So let's say the couple is a carrier couple and they are at risk. You want to offer them amniocentesis or CVS to give a diagnosis. And another scenario is, let's say the patient is a carrier and you're unable to offer their partner carrier screening. Either they're in the military, or they used a gamete donor, or they're not in touch anymore, or any of those kinds of scenarios. Nowadays, you can offer CVS or amnio with full gene sequencing of that condition, and you can look for any pathogenic variants in that gene, and you'll usually be able to give reasonable guidance to those patients. And when you find a carrier, it's really important to make a pedigree, to draw out the family history, because it helps us really identify all the other potential carriers that are involved. So you start with one patient, and classically we represent XX patients as circles, and XY males as squares. So you start with a patient here, and she's a carrier for some condition. Already you can tell her, all of your siblings, each has a 50-50 chance of being a carrier, and one of your parents is a carrier because usually, as is usually the case, you've inherited it from one of your parents. And so now you can say all of your siblings, and it may be your cousins on your father's side or on your mother's side, but they should all be tested. And in this example, when this woman found out that she was a carrier, she said, you know what, my brother has a child who's going through something. They're not exactly sure of the diagnosis, and they're pregnant with a new baby. I'm going to share this information with my brother. It may help them get closer to a diagnosis. And so that's really how it goes. And this is called cascade genetic testing, where once you identify one carrier, the door opens up and it helps you identify so many more carriers, which can help other couples in the future. And so we always tell our patients, now you're the genetic counselor. There aren't enough people in the genetics workforce. And now we're going to rely on you a little bit to inform the rest of the people in your family so that they can get the information that they need. And then a word about test reports. So when we do carrier screening, again, we're not trying to add a lot of confusion. Sometimes due to the things that I described, like genotype phenotype correlation or manifesting carriers, can get a little bit tricky. But in general, carrier screening, it's done by sequencing. So any change in the gene will be identified, but the labs are only going to report pathogenic or likely pathogenic variants in a gene. And so when genetic testing is performed nowadays, there's actually five categories of variants that we could find. A variant can be called pathogenic. It could be likely pathogenic, which was at least a 90% certainty that it is disease causing or detrimental to the gene. Then there's something called a variant of uncertain significance, where the evidence is thin and maybe there are a few case reports that say it's benign and a few that may support the idea that it is pathogenic. Then there's something called likely benign, and then there's benign. And so carrier screening test results are not going to report likely benign or benign results or variants of uncertain significance. And the reason it's important for us to know is, let's say you're testing someone and your patient is a carrier for a condition. And then you test the partner and their test was negative. But let's say that partner's family history is really suspicious and you really just feel like maybe there really is something going on and it seems like you want to learn a little bit more and you want to dig in, you can call the lab and ask them to report any variants of uncertain significance for that partner who had initially had negative testing. Because the way that variants are classified as of today, it doesn't always stay that way. And variants move amongst the different classifications as more information is ascertained. So as we learn more about the different phenotypic repercussions of genetic variants, we can take a variant that's initially classified as variant of uncertain significance and downgrade it to something as benign. But sometimes something that's likely benign gets bumped up to likely pathogenic. And so it's just good to know that we have that option of unmasking variants of uncertain significance in a case where you're really suspicious and a couple is really desperate for answers. And you can use that information going forward to try and really pursue what's going on in that family. Okay, and so now this is all to set the stage. So I was really proud to be part of a new guideline that we put out from ACMG. It's entitled Screening for Autosomal Recessive and X-Linked Conditions During Pregnancy and Preconception, which is a practice resource from the American College of Medical Genetics. And, you know, this guideline was written with three main goals in mind. The first goal was really to identify more patients who are either carriers and to identify more carrier couples. And this is really the time to do this because what the massive advances in technology have allowed us to test many more patients and many more genes at a much faster rate and at a much lower cost. And so knowing that that's available now, we want to be able to reach as many carriers as possible so that they could have the most reproductive options. The second goal was that we needed a better format of communication between doctors and patients and laboratories. Because when we say expanded carrier screening, it's really a very hard term to define. Every lab has a different set of conditions that they offer for expanded carrier screening. And we really just wanted to have more precision in the language used amongst all people involved in carrier screening. And so we developed a tiered system to describe levels of carrier screening. And the last goal was really to address the fact that the historical approach to carrier screening, which was based on offering testing to certain at-risk populations, it's really scientifically flawed and also ethically a little bit unfair. We know, due to the power of genomic testing, that self-reported ancestry is flawed, and people don't always get it right, and there are surprises. And so you don't want to exclude any patient due to their own self-reported ancestry. And also, there are populations that are really not being offered testing as much as they should be, and they're not being able to take advantage of all that science and medicine has to offer in this field. And so to address the idea of a better format of communication, we developed a tiered system. So tier one carrier screening would be really just cystic fibrosis and SMA plus risk-based screening based on, like, let's say Ashkenazi Jewish or African American. And that's supported by ACMG and ACOG from years past. Tier two screening is everything in tier one, but also including any condition that has a carrier frequency of greater than 1 in 100. Tier three screening is any condition that has a carrier frequency of equal to or greater than 1 in 200 in any group with reasonable representation in the United States. And the team took a lot of care and time to screen, to look at every single gene that would be offered to see if there is a representation and any kind of any condition with a frequency of greater than 1 in 200 would be included in this list. And it also includes some X-linked conditions. And tier four screening would be anything beyond that, right? So sometimes labs are going to offer more than tier three screening, and it's not going to be something that's recommended by this practice guideline, but it's something that could, that is out there, and we can use this terminology to describe any kind of bigger testing. And another part of our change in language is to just, we're proposing to leave the term expanded carrier screening and just call it carrier screening. And in terms of the ethical considerations, then we really just want to have a more ethnic and population neutral approach where the same carrier screening is going to be offered to every single patient. And so I wanted to share a few cases with you, which I always think brings home some of the concepts. So case one, we had a 31-year-old G0. So this is a woman who presented for preconception counseling. She had a diagnosis of anxiety, OCD, and infertility. And she came because she was really worried. She had carrier screening, and she was told that she was a carrier for alpha thalassemia. And her partner had carrier screening and was told that he was a carrier for beta thalassemia. And so her doctor told her, great, it really kind of cancels each other out. And I have this diagram here on the side just to remind us, hemoglobin is made out of two beta subunits and two alpha subunits. And when disease happens in alpha thalassemia, if you don't have enough alpha globin, you will end up having an excess of the beta globins, and that will lead to anemia. And the same thing happens with beta thalassemia. If you have too little of the normal beta globin, you will have an excess of alpha globin proteins, which clump together and precipitate and lead to anemia. And so it is true that if you're missing one of each, you usually don't have a severe course. But this patient, so she was told reassuring news, then she went to see a hematologist who told her, no, she is at risk to have a baby with anemia. And she was totally confused. And so we just had to take a second look. And this is an example where you just have to really read the report. And she was called a carrier for alpha thalassemia, but in fact, she just had an extra copy. She had a duplication of one of her alpha globin genes. And so she actually didn't have four sets of genes making alpha globin. She had five. So she, and then her husband had a mutation, a pathogenic mutation in one of the beta globin genes. So that in truth, the couple was at risk. They had a 25% risk to have a child with an anemia, which was predicted to be mild, but potentially even transfusion dependent. And this gave a lot of clarity to the couple. After meeting with hematologists, they decided this was not something that they were going to pursue IVF for, and they were not going to test their embryos for this condition. They were going to just use the information to take good care of the baby. A second case we had was a 23-year-old G1, para0010, who came again for preconception counseling. She had just recently had a miscarriage, and it was triploidy based on the genetic testing of the products of conception. But in those few weeks where she was pregnant, she had carrier screening, which found that she had a likely pathogenic variant in the factor 9 gene. So she was a carrier for X-linked hemophilia B. And so when she learned about this, she realized, okay, so half of my boys will have hemophilia B. And she started asking questions. Will he be able to play sports? Will he be able to live a normal life? And should I go and have IVF and select out embryos that are not affected? Her family, there was a cousin who recently also found she was a carrier, and her cousin was pursuing IVF for this exact reason. But this patient wanted to do more research, and she said, you know what, I have a lot of male first cousins, and their mother is an obligate carrier. And so what we did was we tested all of her male cousins to see if any of them were affected, because they were all healthy. In her case, it would have been a win to find that all of them had this mutation and nothing happened, but just by luck has it, none of them had the mutation. But she has two male nephews, and her sister is considering testing them because the family really wants to know, is this variant serious enough that we should either consider terminating a pregnancy or pursuing IVF and pouring in a lot of money and effort, or should we, in her own words, roll the dice and hope for a very mild disease? If the baby should inherit the variant. So case three was a 25-year-old female. She was half Ashkenazi Jewish and half Sephardi Jewish, and she came with her husband, who is Ashkenazi Jewish. They were a couple who wanted to start building a family, but they were concerned because her mother found that she had a BRCA1 mutation, and she wanted testing. So we had a short discussion about how maybe she should look into getting life insurance. So we put the BRCA testing on hold. She was gonna go and get life insurance. And then we offered her carrier screening. And this couple actually initially didn't wanna do it. They had done something called Dor Yesharim, which is carrier screening that's offered in the Orthodox Jewish community to couples who are considering getting matched up for, you know, for marriage. And the results are not revealed to the patients, but they're just told whether or not they are a carrier couple or not. So if they're a carrier couple, they're advised not to go on their first date. And so they had gone through Dor Yesharim and they were cleared in that process. But after some consideration, they did accept full updated carrier screening, and she was found to be a carrier for Gaucher and SMA. And this led to her sharing the information with her siblings, who were all in reproductive years, and they also had carrier screening and had the chance to look into it. Her husband, thankfully, was not a carrier for any of the conditions. Ultimately, she also returned for BRCA testing, and that was negative, so it was a good ending to that case. Case number four was a patient who was referred to us for a CVS. So the father of the baby, her partner, has a child from a previous relationship with sickle cell disease. And on carrier screening, our patient was found to have sickle cell trait. So she was a carrier. And we did diagnostic testing, and the fetus was a CVS. The fetus was found to have one copy of the hemoglobin S. So we predicted that the fetus was at least a carrier, but it was reassuring because not affected. When the father returned for follow-up testing, we actually ran hemoglobin electrophoresis on him, and we found that he was actually not a carrier for sickle cell anemia, rather beta thalassemia. So when it all is said and done, we were able to look back and tell him, you know, your son likely has sickle beta thalassemia, which may really present very similarly to sickle cell disease. Another interesting case, you know, patients will really want to talk a lot once they have more of the information. Oftentimes you have to use other specialists because no one provider can be an expert in everything. So this is a 37-year-old G2 para 1 who came for preconception counseling. So she has a healthy baby at home, and before considering getting pregnant again, she did carrier screening, and she found that she and her husband had variants in the PAH gene, which leads to PKU. So they were wondering, should we, you know, PKU, it's pretty serious intellectual disability. You have to have a very restrictive diet your whole life. You know, are we at a 25% risk to have a baby that could never have a steak, could never go out with their friends? And are they going to always have to have blood draws and many doctor's visits? You know, like maybe we shouldn't set ourselves up for that kind of situation. So I sent them to meet with a metabolic geneticist who was able to tell them there's a PKU genetics database. And one of the variant that the mother was carrying actually was shown to leave patients with a 63% residual enzyme activity, which is a lot. And he carried a mutation that leads to 23% residual enzyme activity. So the couple was counseled, if you have a baby who's homozygous and inherits both of your mutations, this offspring is predicted to have a pretty much a milder clinical course. And they were really reassured by that. Their plan is that they're going to conceive naturally. They will still pursue prenatal diagnosis so that they can be as prepared as possible for the birth of a child who might need certain differences in care right at birth. And PKU is on newborn screening as well. My next case is a 43-year-old female who presented at 10 weeks after IVF. And she came to the maternal fetal medicine practice because she herself had a history of a thyroid nodule and hepatitis B. On carrier screening, she was found to have not one, but two pathogenic variants in the ALPL gene, which cause autosomal recessive hypophosphatasia. And if you take a look at the report, if you could read it, it says positive carrier, hypophosphatasia, autosomal recessive, homozygous. And so they're trying to say to you, listen, this is recessive, but she's homozygous. This patient might be affected. And what's interesting about hypophosphatasia is that there's a really wide spectrum of manifestations. So at worst, hypophosphatasia can lead to soft bones and even fetal death, so miscarriage. Or in children, it can even look like rickets. And there are milder onset where there's adult onset bone fractures. And the mildest form is really just related to teeth. And you have people who will report losing teeth with the entire root intact. So when we learned about this, we brought the patient back for further discussion, family history. And we learned that she actually lost many of her adult teeth and she was wearing dentures. We just didn't even think to ask her that question. So the counseling for her was that all of her offspring will inherit one pathogenic variant. And even that might be an issue because sometimes carriers do manifest to a certain degree. Her partner was not a carrier, thankfully. And the plan for this patient was to send her for early bone mineral density screening. And in patients with hypophosphatasia, it is advised not to use bisphosphonate. So it's a really big and important finding for this patient. So this was really useful. I could go on and on, but my take-home points for the group is that hopefully with the new guidelines and with time as laboratories look at the panels that they're ordering and also with the support of all the medical colleges, eventually carrier screening for all should be covered by insurance for all patients. So hopefully we'll be able to see a more equitable approach. And it's not just all patients, but I'm also referring to all providers, right? So people should feel empowered. Even primary care doctors can offer carrier screening with a little bit of practice on what to put into the discussion for pretest counseling and post-test counseling. And all new pregnancies, all new couples, all the time. Usually you want to try when you're not pregnant, but if you catch someone in pregnancy, you want to offer it. And really all patients should be screened for all the exact same set of conditions. And we're going to try and use the word tier 3 carrier screening to refer to those conditions. Thank you so much for participating. You can always phone a friend. This is my contact. And genetic counselors are the best, and they work in lots of different places, primary care offices, specialty offices, OBGYN offices, and also at laboratories, and they would always be happy to speak to you. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. I think that was such a wonderful broad overview. You know, I think that some of the questions from the chat were similar to what I was wondering. Do you have any great resources for our listeners at the OBG Project for where they could find like a brief clinical description of a disorder? Maybe, for example, something like SMA or some of the more common ones, like how would we go about figuring out how to describe that?
Okay, so I use something that's available to all people. It's called Gene Reviews. And so if you type in any genetic condition, space, gene reviews, one word, you'll get a really good description. So, and it's really pretty easy for a medical provider to read. The first paragraph will give you the clinical synopsis, and you don't need to have a subscription. It's not like you have to log into anything to use it, and it's readily available. And I love that resource.
Oh, that sounds amazing. I will definitely be checking that out shortly. And can you talk a little bit about how to counsel a patient who's a carrier for SMA?
Sure. So SMA is a really severe condition, but luckily it's recessive. So if you're a carrier for SMA, you're not expected to have any issues. But if your partner is also a carrier for SMA, then you would have a 25% chance of having a baby with that condition. So SMA is stands for spinal muscular atrophy, and it's a progressive neurologic disease that affects the spinal motor neurons. And so a healthy baby will, you'll see slowly losing the ability to talk, walk, feed on their own. And there's levels of severity, but the most severe and the most classic form is onset in infancy or early childhood. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about SMA or offering SMA carrier screening to all couples is that there is new treatment for SMA, which is an enzyme treatment. And I really encourage people to find out if they're carriers, even if they don't want to do prenatal diagnosis. But if the neurologist knows that they're expecting a baby that might be affected, then they'll stay in touch with me and they'll say, let me know when she's coming in. I'm going to order the treatment now, right? So I'm going to get this baby the treatment, and hours matter, and we want to be able to give it to that baby as soon as possible. The medicine is not so readily available, and so it takes a while to order it and ship it and have it available. And so just the knowledge there is so useful to be able to offer a treatment that can give you a milder course or prevent some of the more severe manifestations.
Great, thank you. Yeah, I think that that's so helpful because it's not something that we see or have that much experience with as OBGYNs, you know, but having to counsel on all those things.
And I'll say also, a lot of times there isn't something like a treatment that you can give right away, right? So. Right. You can just say, well, you'll just find out when the baby is born. But in this case, knowing that, let's say you have an affected baby, right? Let's say you do an amniocentesis and the couple decides, okay, we're going to have this baby, and you know the baby is affected. Then you can say, okay, we're going to deliver you at 40 weeks, and right. We're going to call neurology, and they're going to be available, and they're going to order the medicine. And so I almost really encourage prenatal diagnosis in those cases because, first of all, prenatal diagnosis is really safe. CVS and amniocentesis carry a very low risk of miscarriage in experienced hands. Mm-hmm. And the prior knowledge can potentially help the baby.
Yeah. You know, and I think that for our last question, because we're almost out of time, what are your thoughts? And you touched a little bit upon it in terms of life insurance and just general insurance in the context of having a lot more information on our own genetics and how you've kind of seen that play out as this becomes more and more common, especially if we're going to be expanding carrier panels and offering more testing for everyone.
Such a good question, right? So carrier screening
million-dollar question, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, the point is that really, in some cases, it's you do find out something that's clinically significant for the parent or the potential parent, right? So, but luckily, these surprises tend to be more of the mild cases, right? Because if someone had a classic form of a disease, they would know it usually. They would have already known it, but so luckily, it's usually a more mild condition, right? Like it's not PKU, but it's something like a milder form, right? So, but yeah, it's very powerful genetic testing that we're doing because we're sequencing lots and lots of different genes. And so just like we always knew as OBGYNs, if you find someone who's a sickle cell carrier, you know that you might want to check their urine for infection and you want to make sure that you keep them super hydrated because we knew that there was something to it. I mean, even Division I athletes have to be tested to see if they're carriers for sickle cell. So it's kind of like comes full circle that, you know, the more conditions you test for, the more often you find it. I haven't seen any practical, I don't have like any real life examples of how it affected someone's insurance, but it's a great question. And yep, sometimes you get a diagnosis, right? Like Gaucher, for instance.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much. I think those were all the questions from our audience. We really appreciate you joining us, and I think that this is really, you know, given us a lot of food for thought in terms of the expanded options for genetics.
Great.
You can all join us next month on March 29th. We're going to be switching gears a little bit, and we'll be having Dr. Ebony Carter on to explain some of the drivers of health disparities in the United States and look a little bit on the impact of implicit bias and racisms on health outcomes, as well as some novel solutions. So stay tuned, and thank you all for joining.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.